Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Revolution Health Radio Show. This show is brought to you by ChrisKresser.com. I'm your show host, Steve Wright, and my website is scdlifestyle.com. With me is integrative medical practitioner and healthy skeptic, Chris Kresser. Chris, how's the day going out there in California?
Oh, it's pretty good. Just busy, getting back in the swing of things after Paleo FX. How are you?
Same here. Paleo FX was a great time, and it was so much work to be done as we got back that my bags are still packed.
Right. So I'm super excited about our guest today. His name is Moises Velasquez-Manoff, and he's the author of one of the best books I've read in a long time, and probably one of the best science books I've ever read. It's called Epidemic of Absence, A New Way of Understanding Autoimmune Diseases and Allergies. And it's essentially about the hygiene hypothesis, which I've mentioned before on the show and I've written about. One of the basic premises of the ancestral health movement is that there's a fundamental mismatch between human biology and genetics and the current environment that we're living in. But this mismatch isn't always black or white. A lot of modern developments are kind of a double-edged sword. So, for example, antibiotics absolutely prevent infection, have reduced rates of infection, have saved lives. And before the invention of antibiotics, a lot of people died that aren't dying now from acute illness. But of course, on the other hand, antibiotics may have permanently altered the human gut microbiome, and due to their effect on the gut flora, they can predispose us to a lot of different chronic diseases and cause a lot of problems. Another example would be C-section, which has certainly reduced infant mortality, particularly in some populations, but a lot of recent research suggests that babies born to C-section may be predisposed to obesity, metabolic disease, and other chronic health problems later on in their life. And then, of course, we have modern food processing and distribution that has made starvation a lot less likely, but the ready availability of calories is something that we're just not really adapted to, and that's probably contributed to the epidemics of obesity and metabolic disease. So it appears that modern sanitation and hygiene may be another one of these double-edged swords of modern civilization, and that's what we're going to talk to Moises about.
Yeah, I'm very pumped for this. I think it's going to be a great discussion, and we should probably get him on the show.
Let's do it.
Okay, well, before we bring Moises on the show, let me first tell the listeners about Beyond Paleo. So if you're new to the paleo diet, or you're just interested in optimizing your health, you're going to want to check out what over 30,000 other people have already signed up for. It's called Beyond Paleo. This is Chris's free 13-part email series on burning fat, boosting energy, and preventing and reversing disease without drugs. To sign up, go over to ChrisKresser.com and look for the big red box. Go ahead and put your name and email in that box, and Chris will start sending the first email right away.
So welcome to the show, Moises. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So maybe we can start just by you telling us how you got interested in science writing in the first place. I'm curious about that, since science writing is not... It seems like it's been experiencing a renaissance, certainly in the past 10 or 15 years, but it's still maybe not the most common career.
Yeah, well, I had always wanted to be a fiction writer, I suppose, of novels and short stories when I was younger. And I did the sort of usual thing where I got a day job to make ends meet and tried to write early in the mornings and, dealt with all that fun frustration. But then I decided I was graphic designing and doing other things, and I decided if I really wanted to make a go of writing, I had to go back to school. I went back to school. I specialized in science writing, mostly because I think there was one moment where I was covering something political, like in the local sort of New York City politics, and I just realized that everyone was trying to spin everything all the time. And I said, I really don't want to do this, like deal with this kind of stuff all the time. I want to deal with people who are actually trying to get at some sort of truth. And that is, of course, at least that's one interpretation of what science is trying to do. You create hypotheses and you test them somehow empirically. And of course, I'm just, I'm a curious person. I like to know how things work. So science was a natural draw.
Right. And then when did you first become interested in the hygiene hypothesis, or old friends, as we're calling it now?
Well, there was a moment actually in grad school, I think around 2005 or six, I was doing some research, and I came across one article on Joel Weinstock's work in the journal Science. You've probably read the same article. It was about his development of the pig whipworm for the treatment of inflammatory mm-hmm. bowel disease. Mm-hmm. And I had never come across anything like the hypothesis he presented, which flipped, you know, everything that I had learned previously on its head.
Right.
Everything else basically argued something along the lines of, we're exposed to some new pollutant or something that's wreaking havoc on our immune system in the modern world. And there are certainly lots of possible exposures these days. It's messing with our immune system, thus the increase in these diseases like asthma and various autoimmune diseases. He was saying the opposite. He was saying we're missing something that's been with us since time immemorial. It's been with us so long that it's actually shaped our immune system. Our immune system fails to function correctly in its absence. And you know, you just follow that hypothesis and that trail of breadcrumbs, and it ends up leading you to some amazing science.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember being just so blown away when I first came across it, and I think I was perhaps somewhat open to it as an idea because, of course, a lot of what I write and speak about is this concept that humans now, you know, our biology and genes are somewhat mismatched with the modern environment. So from that perspective, it seemed like another expression of that mismatch and another sort of double-edged sword where, you know, improvements in modern sanitation and hygiene have certainly saved a lot of lives. But there, as it turns out, there's a dark side to this, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So can you explain the difference between the hygiene hypothesis and the old friends hypothesis, and, you know, how they, you know, what's the difference in those two perspectives?
Well, it clears it up a little bit to understand the history. The hygiene hypothesis stems from a study in 1989 on large families, showing that younger kids in large families that had many older siblings were relatively protected against allergic disease compared to the older siblings. The guy who originally formulated it, David Strachan, an epidemiologist, he thought it was infection. So you're a young kid, you're born, you have four older brothers, and they just keep giving you all these nasty infections, and that ends up protecting you. It turns out that was probably wrong. There's not much evidence or any evidence really suggesting that acute infections like the flu or like measles help in terms of preventing these diseases. What's probably more important is that you're born into this microbially enriched environment. You know, you have all these older brothers, they're tracking in the mud, they're tracking in, of course, they could be sisters too. They're tracking in mm-hmm. mud, there's saliva everywhere, there's a little poop here and there, fecal bacteria. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, these days with improved technology, when scientists examine these kinds of environments with lots of children, which also include daycares, they find an enhanced microbial diversity in just sort of in the dust that accumulates. Mm-hmm. That's probably what's important, because it either, one, stimulates your immune system and sort of hits all these receptors on your immune system in a way that it's sort of the equivalent of like, say, you know, hearing good music constantly in the background or something. It just keeps you soothed so you don't over-respond when someone comes along and claps in your ear or something. Mm-hmm. Or it's because some of those microbes are actually key species that colonize you. And then when they take up residence in your gastrointestinal tract or elsewhere, end up calibrating your immune system in a way that prevents wheezing and hay fever and eczema. So the old friends is basically a way of reformulating the hygiene hypothesis, which was focused on infections, refocusing it on what's probably the true protective factor, which are actually innocuous microbes, possibly symbiotic microbes, as in that they're native to our body and we need them. And so that's their old friends because they've been with us for a long time. Now, it turns out that old friends as a category also includes parasites.
Right, which aren't always innocuous, but in the right amount maybe are innocuous and even beneficial. I mean,
you know, the way I think of it, I've come to think of it, is that there's a gradient of organisms. Some on one end are the pure mutualists that are purely in a beneficial relationship with you. You benefit them, they benefit you. On the other end are the pure pathogens, like the plague, like they benefit basically and you die.
Right.
And in the middle, there's a whole lot of other organisms. Medicine has tended to focus on the pathogens so far. But in the middle are the parasites, which they benefit you a little bit just by virtue of the fact that they've always been there, right? So they somehow your immune system actually expects them to be there, even though they take stuff from you. They hurt. They're not always totally benign.
Right. And that one of the analogies I can't remember if you used it or somebody else. I don't think it was in your book, but if you're standing and facing someone and you both have your hands out and you're leaning into each other and all of a sudden somebody steps away, you know, you're going to fall down. And yeah, it's kind of like that background tension that these organisms provided kind of, and our immune system had, it gave it something to do essentially. And then as soon as those organisms were removed from the environment, an adaptation that would have been protective in the presence of those organisms all of a sudden starts attacking self tissue. And then we have this epidemic of allergic and autoimmune disease.
Yeah, that's right.
So with the old friends, you know, what are we talking about here? We're talking about helminths, lactobacilli, other soil-based organisms. What else?
Well, that's a good question. I think we're probably talking about a whole repertoire of heirloom species that are native just to our particular lineage of primate, Homo sapiens. It turns out, you know, the lactobacilli that inhabit a chicken are not the same as the ones that inhabit a pig or that inhabit a human. Mm-hmm. That said, it also seems that we inherit sort of at least genetic capabilities from environmental microbes that don't really colonize us. But as you know, microbes can interchange genetic information. So there's right. this study a few years ago on the Japanese microbiome.
The seaweed.
You're right. And it had this unique ability to break down aspects of seaweed. And it wasn't that a microbe from seaweed had colonized Japanese stomachs. It was that it had imparted this genetic ability to microbes that were already resident in Japanese stomachs.
Right.
But what that sort of – go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. I think you're going to answer my question.
Well, I was going to say that implies – that our connection with the external microbiome via food, via even, you know, fermentation products, via just inhaling air from a living ecosystem, via water that comes from surface sources, is a constant supply of genetic innovation for our microbiome. Mm-hmm. How that might apply to our immune function remains largely unexplored, but it's hard to imagine that it wouldn't.
Right. And it also seems to change the notion, or at least push it forward a little bit, of how probiotics and things like fermented foods might benefit us. I think the typical idea is more like a sort of question of volume. Like if your gut microbiome is depleted, you take in some probiotics or fermented foods and it kind of increases the flora and that's how it works. But it seems like now from my reading, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, that it's a lot more sophisticated and complex than that. It's these bacteria that we're consuming are modulating our immune system and creating changes in our gut that probably do influence the composition of the gut flora, but it's not so much about just filling it back up as it is about the effects that these organisms have on you know, everything from our immunity to our genome.
Yeah.
Or the gut genome, I mean.
Yeah, well, our gut is basically an immune organ, is one of the sort of revelations of all this work. You know, 70% of our immune activity on a day-to-day basis happens around our gut.
Right.
So it's not really just a digestive, you know, this thing that absorbs nutrients, period. It's this place that where our whole immune system is calibrated by our resident microbes. One of the things that keeps showing up, though, is, as we mentioned earlier, is diversity. And what I worry about in terms of the sort of current generation of probiotics is it's always a few strains. I mean, that's how companies that create these microbes work. You patent a strain, and then you sell it, right?
Right.
how is that going to address this question of diversity? It doesn't seem to. And honestly, I have to say that in terms of the science with existing probiotic strains, it's really underwhelming in humans.
Yeah, we're talking about a broad spectrum product might have 13 or 14 species, but you know, we know that there's at least 500 species, and I've seen some studies suggesting that there may be even more in the gut.
Sure.
And I imagine that's why fecal transplants are so much more effective than probiotics, because you're getting the actual wide, broad range of microbiota that exists in a theoretically healthy human host, rather than just a few select strains of lactobacilli, for example.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And they're native. You know, probiotic strains aren't always native to the human gut. Doesn't mean they don't interface,
right?
They don't necessarily take up residence.
Right. So you may have seen this study, Moises, that was recently published. I think it was the American Journal of Human Genetics. And it was a paper by Raj and colleagues. And they were basically speculating that genes that predispose for inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, have been targets of recent positive selection, which of course suggests that these alleles had at some point some benefit to humans. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been selected for, and they wouldn't have been as common as they are now. So with that in mind, why would genes that predispose us for something like inflammatory bowel disease have been selected for?
Well, because they amp up certain aspects of the immune defending response that are probably important what's interesting about those studies that look at positive selection for these alleles is that the time frame for that selection is almost invariably in the last, mostly since the Neolithic revolution, the last 10,000, mm-hmm. 12,000 years, when we're living in increasingly crowded conditions with other humans, other animals, that basically enhance pestilence, right? So hunter-gatherers, small groups of 50 to 70 people, the network as a whole is maybe a few hundred people. Once we start settling down, we're talking thousands and thousands of people living in a smaller space with all these animals. You're not moving, sewer becomes a problem. Suddenly we're starting to develop infections that we're encountering infections that we didn't encounter before in the same quantity. So certain aspects of our immunity get amped up. And what's interesting about thinking on this is that during that same period of our evolution, all the evidence suggests that parasite infections also increased because you're stewing in your own feces, for most of the Neolithic.
Yeah.
And that's how these things, they're oral fecal, transmitted oral fecally. So the parasites suppress your immune systems, including the very kinds of response that defend you against worse pathogens, right? So if you have a parasite, you're much more susceptible to other types of infections that will just kill you in a day.
Mm-hmm.
The parasite won't kill you directly. It just makes you more vulnerable. So in the context of these chronic, relatively heavy parasite loads, it's not surprising in some respects to see a selection for the amping up of aspects of immunity that protect against acute infections. But then if you imagine the human superorganism, the body with all its flora and fauna, including parasites, those alleles, which are the same ones that predispose to autoimmune disorders these days, probably just protected us and didn't cause autoimmune disease because there was this constant drag or sort of cooling effect of the mm-hmm. parasite infection, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's in fact what, analysis by Italian scientists, Matteo Fumagalli, they sort of show this in a very, very, 10,000 foot kind of way, that those alleles are enriched in populations that also had a lot of parasite infections in the recent evolutionary past.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk, a little bit more about that, because going back to Weinstock, when he initially developed a theory on Trichura suis or pig whipworm, at that time, I think that the paradigm of understanding autoimmunity was this idea that there were two sides of the immune system. One side, the Th1 side, that would deal with a certain type of problem, and then the Th2 side would deal with a different type of problem, like parasitic infections, and that inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, often involved an overactive Th1 response, and then introducing the whipworm would ramp up the Th2 side and kind of balance things out. But that's really not the prevailing understanding at this point, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, what's interesting is that Weinstock's original hypothesis was completely at odds with the parallel development of the so-called hygiene hypothesis, mm-hmm. right? Because he was saying that we're skewing the immune response to Th2, thus preventing diseases that are autoimmune or inflammatory characterized by Th1. Meanwhile, the hygiene hypothesis guys are saying, well, we need more Th1 stimulation to avoid this right. excess Th2, which is what creates
allergies,
allergic disease, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So clearly something was going on. And in fact, if you look, there are a few like mouse studies where they tried to actually test this idea, and they took Th1 cells and transplanted them, you know, to see if they could skew it. And of course it didn't work, because then you just end up with double the inflammation of two different kinds.
Right.
What's important is this other arm of the immune system, which suppresses all immune responses, and the regulatory arm. It's sort of epitomized in these regulatory T cells that parasites induce, but also microbes induce. And in fact, it seems that even some certain types of, you know, omega-3s may induce. You know, it's interesting that a lot of foods, it turns out, are actually directly stimulate the immune system.
Right.
In good and bad ways, depending on what they are.
Mm-hmm.
So this new paradigm, you can imagine it as a triplicate. There's Th1, there's Th2, and then regulating either one of those is the regulatory response. And of course, it's not just your T cells, it's turning out there are regulatory B cells, which produce antibodies normally, but these regulatory B cells control other B cells. They're basically, it seems like every immune cell, every white blood cell you have, has a version that attacks and a version that holds back. So there are macrophages that hold back, alternatively activated macrophages. There are dendritic cells that hold back. This seems to be the emerging paradigm. And so the question is, why is that entire repertoire of cells not coming online these days the way it should?
Mm-hmm. And the hypothesis here we're talking about is because of these old friends are missing in our environment. And let's talk about some examples. You had several fascinating examples in your book. One of the ones that I've talked about before in the context of, you know, city versus rural, the contribution that raw milk, there are a few studies that suggested that raw milk might confer some protection against asthma. And you wrote about, not specifically about raw milk per se, but the difference between rates of asthma in rural and city kids. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so those studies emerged from rural areas of Switzerland and Bavaria originally. And so they were comparing farm kids with other rural dwelling people who were not farmers. And it's usually misconstrued as farm kids with, you know, urban kids. But in fact, they were all rural kids.
Right.
And the farming kids just were dramatically less allergic, like one third is allergic.
Mm-hmm.
So they, of course, are exposed to this microbially enriched environment of the cow shed, you know, which is manure and mud and feed is fermented. I don't know if you've ever been on a farm. I hadn't until I actually visited an Amish farm last uh-huh. year. And it's like, once you're there, you realize that there is no way that you are not encountering not only like you're eating stuff just by breathing that you just don't encounter elsewhere.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And in fact, it got me, you know, watching, I shoveled some, the feed is fermented, and it's, of course, that's all lactobacilli.
Right.
And it's all just, the particles are all just floating in the air. You inhale that stuff, but that stuff, you know, ultimately comes out of your lungs and goes down into your stomach. So it got me thinking about prebiotics, which is sort of tangential.
But, right.
I mean, you're eating fermented hay is what it comes down to without realizing it, right?
Right. So these, even the rural kids who weren't, you know, they were presumably exposed to something, but not nearly to the same degree that the kids that were actually living on farms, and there was that big of a difference.
Yeah, well, that's sort of it sort of recast this rural-urban gradient that people had noticed for a long time, and it was really just a farm-non-farm gradient, it seemed.
Mm-hmm. But it's not just microbes necessarily that protect against asthma, because you talk about the Chimane, is that how you pronounce
the
work with? And in their case, it was something different, right?
Well, no one really knows what it is in their case, but it's mm-hmm. very extreme. And so they live in a kind of this transition phase between hunter-gathering and farming. They're called horticulturalists, right? But they live, you know, they live outside, essentially. You know, everything is made from jungle. They live the way that we all used to live, really. But
They're where, Moises?
They're in Bolivia. There's a part of Bolivia, which we usually think of as a mountain country in the Andes, that's actually rainforest. It's the sort of the eastern slope of the Andes.
Mm-hmm.
So they live in the foothills to the Andes, and they've somehow resisted westernization throughout the centuries. And they have a little protected area now, and they live off jungle meat. They live off fruits, but they also live off rice and whatever else was given to them by the Spanish, which they grow in the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
And they have like no asthma, no allergic disease, like startlingly low. It could be genetic. This phenomenon, though, has been observed in other people who live in those kinds of circumstances. Mm-hmm. And they have like almost universal hookworm infection.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, very high rates of hookworm. So let's talk a little bit about Sardinia and rates of autoimmune diseases. I found that to be really interesting. You mentioned the Italian study that found that people who had higher rates of parasite infection previously had, you know, were more likely to have genes that predispose them to autoimmune disease. Is that what was going on in Sardinia?
Yeah, that's the theory. So Sardinians are very genetically unique in the European family, almost like they're not really European. In some respects, the, you know, Iranians are more related to Europeans than to mainland Europeans than our Sardinians are.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting, actually. I saw a study that, you know, the Iceman, that guy Ötzi, who showed up in a glacier, he's 5,300 years old.
Sure.
He's like an archaic European population. He actually has polymorphisms that are related to current day Sardinians. So he's more related to them. So maybe it was more widespread in the past before whatever happened. In any case, they've been isolated for a long time. They didn't really mix in, although the island has been ruled by everyone from the Phoenicians to the Spanish most recently. And they've been plagued by malaria, by the nasty one, Plasmodium falciparum.
Mm-hmm.
So they, the theory goes, evolved defenses against it. Now, the classic defense is sickle cell, the sickle cell trait, right, where you have one copy of this gene and you're protected from cerebral malaria. You're not protected from infection. You're protected from dying from
mm-hmm.
infection.
Mm-hmm.
So it's likely that there are other adaptations, and in fact, there are. Thalassemia is another one. It's another kind of anemia, which is very common in Sardinia and actually correlates with altitude in Sardinia. So that the higher altitudes where there are fewer mosquitoes, they have this trait less often.
Right.
But there's the whole island. Everyone was constantly sort of attacked by this parisite. And then in the post-World War II, 1950s, they moved to eradicate it. And they did eradicate it in the matter of like a few years, funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. And immediately, autoimmune disease started increasing, type 1 diabetes and multiple sclerosis, such that these days, they're probably maybe number one for multiple sclerosis, even though some areas of Canada might be higher,
mm-hmm.
And Scotland maybe as well. But they're number two for type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune diabetes.
Right.
And it began immediately after the eradication of malaria. Now, malaria is a kind of chronic infection, right? And there's mm-hmm. a theme here that chronic infections, if you get them early enough in life, prevent the onset of autoimmune disease, because any chronic infection, it means that some animal or some microbe, in this case, these plasmodia, are manipulating your immune system such that your immune system doesn't destroy them and expel them, right?
Right.
Part of how they do that is by inducing those regulatory cells. And malaria, chronic malaria infection, does indeed have a very strong component of regulatory T cells, you know, so that in Africa these days, if you go to the countryside where everyone has the parasite, people have more regulatory T cells circulating than they do in the cities where fewer people have the parasite.
Mm-hmm. And they even have more things like rheumatoid factor that where it's not problematic in them, whereas high levels of rheumatoid factor here can mean something like rheumatoid arthritis.
Yeah, that's right. And so the meta picture is that the things that we now, the activation of the immune system that we now associate with autoimmune disease in its proper context, which is usually some kind of chronic infection, it doesn't, it's actually part of a defense mechanism. And the question is, what's missing? You know, you get the elevated rheumatoid factor, say, what's missing? It's usually that activated regulatory aspect that's also elevated. So you get rheumatoid factor and then some regulatory aspect elevated. That's how it looked throughout our evolution. That's how it was activated. These days, it just gets sort of activated, just the pro-inflammatory part of it gets activated, and then it produces disease, right?
Right.
We need to sort of figure out ways to reactivate that regulatory part as well to protect ourselves from disease.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that. But before we do, I want to talk about another specific example, which, I mean, you mentioned earlier the spectrum of organisms that maybe on the one end you have mutualists that are, you know, just beneficial and they don't really cause any harm at all. On the other hand, you have pure pathogens that basically provide no benefit to us and just kill us. And then in the middle, you have, you know, organisms that perhaps are capable of causing harm in certain situations or maybe at certain concentrations or at certain times of life and that are capable of benefiting us in other circumstances. So I thought H. pylori is probably the best example of a middle ground there because, of course, we know it's associated with gastric cancer and a lot of other problems, but you also mentioned in your book that there's some evidence that it could be an old friend in certain circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, let me preface this whole story by saying that I don't think anyone who's an adult who should go out and try to get an H. pylori infection.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time trying to get rid of it, that's for sure.
But it's also because that interpretation of these findings totally ignores the aspect of timing of when these things arrive, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So, and that's really important. So in the animal studies of an H. pylori, where it is protective against asthma, it has to arrive early. And the earlier it arrives, the more protective it is. The later it arrives, the more inflammation it causes and the more it predisposes to gastric cancer. So that speaks to this thing called the African enigma, which is this observation that why don't Africans get stomach cancer? Everyone has H. pylori. One answer to that is they get it so early that it actually doesn't cause as much inflammation as it does cause in populations that are in transition or in Western populations.
Right.
Another possibility, I mean, it's also probably because they have different strains there, which are less carcinogenic, but another possibility is that other infections or other just residents of the microbiome modulate the impact. So there was a recent study actually on lactobacilli that if you had these bacteria, it protected against the carcinogenic effects of H. pylori.
Interesting.
Another one is our parasites, or worm infections.
Mm-hmm.
They also both observationally and experimentally seem to protect against carcinogenic aspects of this bug.
And then what about lifespan? You know, for our ancestors, I think I recall from your book, you know, with the rates of gastric cancer is certainly a disease that tends to develop later in life. And if the average lifespan of our ancestors was lower, then perhaps it wasn't as much of a problem. And so it wasn't, you know, we didn't evolve a defense to it like we would have otherwise.
Right. So it's interesting. If you talk to Martin Blaser, who's the proponent of the H. pylori is actually a resident of your stomach idea and sort of spearheaded this whole line of inquiry, he'll say that actually part of the good that it does to you is it kills you off when you're old. Because it, you know, having like old people around who just drain resources, don't actively contribute, is actually, if you look at the sort of group selection theory idea of a group of humans who are selected, is a major drag. There are, you know, a lot of anthropologists would disagree with him.
Yeah, that might not go over so well in some circles.
No. Right. And, you know, he would say, well, you know, I didn't make this up. These are just the rules of life in the old days. But
yeah,
there's some great work by the epidemiologist Amnon Sonnenberg looking at this. So the African enigma, turns out there wasn't a European enigma. It's just that it's buried in the past, right? Mm-hmm. So he did this work where he looked at death certificates and was able to sort of put together the rates of gastric cancer and gastric ulcers. And what he sees basically is that in Europe, with the Industrial Revolution, suddenly everything starts going up. Gastric cancer starts going up. And then like about a few decades later, gastric ulcers start going up while gastric cancer starts declining. So the idea is that there's this baseline where it's not causing as much disease. And he's comparing like age groups with like age groups. So he's not seeing effect of just shorter lifespan. It's just that 60-year-olds didn't used to get as much gastric cancer, say. That's basically what he's seeing, right? Mm-hmm. And so this speaks to this sort of the things we're talking about in the beginning, which is that if there are possibly other individual microbes that protect you against the carcinogenesis of H. pylori, worm infections might protect you, even in old age. So it may have nothing to do with what Martin Blaser argues, that or with this idea that killing off makes it not be deselected for, because, you know, when you die in old age, it doesn't really matter.
Right. Let's move on now and talk about some emerging therapies that have come out of this hypothesis, and then maybe finish up with a discussion of what it sounds like you're a new parent. Is that right, Moises?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so I'm fairly new too. We have a 20-month-old daughter, and maybe we can talk a little bit about what either parents with young kids or people who might have kids in the future might be able to do to, you know, with this in mind, and some ways that we could maybe change the environment and precautions that we could take to help our kids develop a healthy immune system. So I've actually, most of my readers and listeners are familiar, I think, now with fecal transplants. I've written about them and linked to them, and we've talked about them on the show. And you have a chapter, or at least part of a chapter in your book where you talk a little bit about that. Are you following the research on this now, and what do you think their potential is for the future?
Of fecal transplants?
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, in terms of C. diff, it's like a wonder drug. You know, C. diff is pretty horrific. That's the Clostridium difficile, yeah, which is antibiotic resistant often these days. And this is, it's like 95% effective. And, you know, they haven't done huge, huge studies yet, but it's like... So far, the downsides have yet to emerge, and the upsides are almost miraculous, right? Yeah. For C. diff in particular.
I have a doctor here in the East Bay actually who has saved a few lives with fecal transplants, and it's just pretty remarkable what can happen when someone has, you know, taken multiple courses of the most powerful antibiotics and they're still dying, and it can be almost overnight, or within a couple of days that they experience a turnaround.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I mean, as an aside, I don't think that the lesson of why this works and why C. diff is becoming so dangerous has really sunk in. And I think it's C. diff is related to a bunch of bacteria that are actually quite good. There's these clostridial clusters,
sure,
that include a bunch of anti-inflammatory bacteria. And it's plausible that the retreat of those bacteria from our guts because of diet, because of antibiotics, has opened up a niche for a related bacteria to sort of expand.
Right.
So the implications being that C. diff is not necessarily, you know, the antibiotic resistance is clearly new, but the existence is not. It's been around for a long time. It colonizes, you know, a huge number of infant stomachs without causing problems. We all carry probably a good number of us anyways carry it all the time. So why is it causing disease all of a sudden? And it's probably because of sort of extinctions that are happening within.
Right. Makes sense.
I mean, that's a little bit tangential, but in terms of addressing these other diseases, like autoimmune diseases, maybe metabolic diseases, you know, if it's true that the microbes are unique to you and that your community is unique to you, it's probably worthwhile to inject a note of caution, because it could be that you end up causing worse things, you know, like sort of messing things up in these much more complicated disorders that don't relate to one bug wreaking havoc. And everybody who I talk to usually says some version of that to me. And so, they're much more interested in like symbiotics or prebiotics, like figuring out how to modulate drugs that are good that you already have.
Boost right? the innate population. It's a way of amplifying your own existing pattern without amplifying right. the bad, the parts that have gone awry. I guess that's the trick is finding prebiotics that selectively stimulate the growth of the beneficial bacteria rather than the parts that have gone out of whack. I think it is interesting. I can't recall if this is from your book or if I came across it elsewhere, that Dr. Boardy, from the Center for Digestive Disease in Australia that started using this procedure, has done at least one study of fecal transplants for chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yeah.
With some, I think it was a pretty small study. You might recall the details better than I, but it is interesting because as you said before, 70 to 80% of the immune system resides in the gut associated lymphoid tissue, and so there's at least it's not hard to imagine how a fecal transplant could benefit several other conditions beyond something like C. diff, but the note of caution is definitely warranted because we don't yet understand how the gut microbiota, it feels like we're just scratching the surface here in terms of understanding. I will say though that I was at a conference recently and I ran into somebody there who had done a fecal transplant. I'm not sure how they did it or where they got it. This person did gut symptoms were one of them, the main symptoms that this person experienced, but they had also struggled for a long time with weight and extreme fatigue. And she had lost 10 or 15 pounds relatively immediately. Her energy level just turned around almost overnight and her longstanding gut symptoms disappeared relatively quickly. So it seems to have a lot of promise, but it's, I think another problem is finding donors that are qualified, and this I'm always urging my patients and listeners and readers not to just try this at home. It can be really dangerous if you introduce, if someone else can have a pathogen or an organism that doesn't cause problems for them because their system is used to that, like we've been saying, or their gut flora is healthier, and if you introduce that into a system that's immunocompromised or the gut flora is really poor, then it could certainly cause a lot of problems. So please don't take this into your own hands at this point.
Yeah. Well, and if you must, do it with someone you live with, because you probably already have been exposed to their microbiota anyways.
That's right. So what about helminth therapy? We've kind of touched on Trichura suisse pig whipworm, and this is from Weinstock developed this, and I think maybe worth pointing out that pig whipworm at least is for the most part thought to not colonize human hosts, and that's one of the reasons it was chosen. But it seems like there have been some recent studies that suggest that there are maybe some risks to using whipworm.
Yeah, well, there's one study of a teenage boy who took it for his Crohn's. And his status worsened, and then they looked, they did an endoscopy, and there was in their eyes what qualified as a sexually mature worm hanging on in there. And one thing that I've never understood about Trichura suisse, the science so far is very compelling, but is that generally speaking, zoonotic parasite infections are very, very damaging to the hosts because they don't, because the parasites are very host specific and everybody's immune system works a little bit differently. Now, it may turn out that pigs, and they do have a very similar digestive system to ours, and they're omnivores just like we are, have a similar enough immune system, that doesn't matter. But I mean, if you get like a dog hookworm, that'll cause horrible, almost inflammatory bowel disease like symptoms in humans. Mm-hmm. Or, the seal, the worm that you get from eating fish that are undercooked, that's native to seals, that can even lead to convulsions, But that said, the reason Joel Weinstock chose this worm is that he surmised in Iowa, where he was at the time, that so many pig farmers, it's the number one pig producing state in the country, encountered this worm and they had no problems with it, that it must be safe. And I think he was probably mostly right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like the reports have been pretty rare of any significant issue. And at least some of the studies, I haven't looked into any more recent research, but back when I was looking into this, which was several years ago, I think I remember seeing some remission rates for Crohn's disease up around 70%, which pretty remarkable. If you look at any other treatment for Crohn's, it's not 70%, and the side effects of some of the treatments, like the immunosuppressant drugs, like Imuran and Remicade and prednisone, certainly are pretty rough. So is it just Ovamed in Germany that's still doing this, or is anybody doing this in the U.S.? They weren't last time I had checked.
Well, Ovamed is the producer of these eggs. They have, you know, the good manufacturing process approval from the FDA. But the company that's now taking it forward for FDA approval is Coronado Biosciences out of Boston. And they signed some deal with Ovamed to now produce them stateside. So they're going to be produced here, you know, in these miniature Danish pigs kept in very hygienic conditions, I think. Right. And they have trials in the work for MS, for inflammatory bowel disease, for type 1 diabetes, which is very interesting because they're aiming to prevent the onset of type 1 diabetes in people at risk, which is really the best application of any of this stuff, would be to prevent disease, right?
So they would screen a population, you know, if someone had a strong risk profile for when are they talking about introducing it, like early in childhood or?
Yeah, well, the population already exists that's being followed, that's at risk by another group. And usually it's like familial, you know, prevalence in the family, you know, someone has it. And plus it's associated with certain HLA receptors, which are genetic. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, there, you know, before you have full-blown type 1 diabetes, certain self-directed antibodies show up. And it's like you have to have, I think, two or three of them before you actually have diabetes. So they can catch it when you just have one. That's when they can introduce it.
Wow, that's really exciting. And I agree that doing it then before the onset is certainly makes a lot more sense. And this, of course, is probably how it happened for, you know, hundreds of thousands of generations.
Yeah.
I mean, along those lines, well, before we go on to kind of prevention, let's talk a little bit about Nectar Americanus and human hookworm. Do you... You talked about this a little bit in your book, and this is not a legal, or I'm not sure about the legality, but it's not an approved treatment right now. Nevertheless, there are people who are out there doing it and trying it, and there's some pretty interesting studies on it. So tell us a little bit about that and what you see as the, you know, potential future for human hookworm as a therapeutic agent.
Well, so hookworm as a possible treatment was pioneered by scientists at the University of Nottingham. And they of course, were aware of Joel Weinstock's work. And their argument was basically along the lines of what I said earlier. Like, if we want a parasite, it should be a human-adapted parasite.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those are the very qualities that Joel Weinstock was trying to avoid because he didn't want to risk spreading it from person to person. I mean, we spent a lot of money in this country trying to get rid of hookworm specifically.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe in Britain, because they never had a hookworm problem, they were a little bit more nonchalant about it. But in any case, they tried it on humans. They did a very low dose. After these dose-ranging trials on themselves, the scientists tested it on themselves first, between 10 and 100 worms, and the people at 100 were, you know, deathly ill.
Right.
And the people at 50 were, like, pretty deathly ill. 25 hurt a little bit. So they went with 10, and then nothing happened in the trial, so it was too low. So then... there are some people in the world who read the science, found it very compelling, went and got their own hookworms, came up with these stories about how they sent their own diseases into remission, and now sell the hookworms on the black market. And I interviewed people who used it. I joined this so-called hookworm underground. Mm-hmm. I went to a clinic in Tijuana and self-infected. It's not something I would recommend. I didn't have, you know, I interviewed people for whom it was miraculous. I was able to confirm as well with their doctors that it helped. Mm-hmm. I also interviewed people for whom it made things worse. So it's hard to say how much it works. And, you know, it's, you don't know anything until you put it in a real trial. From my own experience, yes, it does modulate your immune system. It's kind of amazing. Like, I had an eczema that went away. You know, I have an autoimmune disorder called alopecia areata. I basically am totally hairless. Mm-hmm. I had like fuzz starting to grow, peach fuzz starting to grow. And my, the best part actually was my, for about half of allergy season, that spring after I self-infected, my hay fever was totally gone. It was just amazing. But then it was all very variable. It was like the effect would come and go and blah, 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 blah. But so I don't recommend it. It doesn't mean that it might not work. And it, and honestly, there are hundreds, possibly thousands of people out there right now who are carrying hookworm. They walk among us. And it was interesting that Joel Weinstock wrote a essay for the journal Nature recently, or actually late last year. And then someone wrote in and said, well, look, you know, people are, you're developing this therapy that has to be approved and yada, yada. And it, but people, meanwhile, are already taking matters in their own hand and seeking and treating themselves with hookworm. Mm-hmm. And these are some professors who study user-driven innovation in the UK. It was just interesting to see that this hookworm underground movement had made it to the pages of the, or at least one of the most prestigious science journals in the world, right?
Right.
And the idea being, will this movement of users accelerate the science? Because the doctors who are the few doctors who are willing to chaperone patients and who see these miraculous improvements in these impossible to treat diseases, and there are a few, mm-hmm. they're inevitably going to, you know, go to conferences and say, look, so-and-so fixed his intractable Crohn's disease. We've already resected, you know, 2 feet of his bowel. And that now he's been in remission for 3 years. Like, maybe we should figure out how to study this more closely or mm-hmm. whatever the case may be. And in fact, I've argued with scientists. I've tried to urge them to do case studies on these people who are self-infected. Of course, the problem being that you can't, in the U.S. anyways, no internal review board is going to give ethics approval for this kind of thing, right?
Right.
But if someone shows up with an infection already, it's a different story, right? Uh-huh. So
that you had no prior knowledge of, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you didn't participate in. And one of the new major hypotheses concerning inflammatory bowel disease emerged from just such a case study where a guy acquired a whipworm infection in Thailand and sent his ulcerative colitis into remission. This was human whipworm, not pig whipworm. Mm-hmm. And then had a scientist named Pong Lok study him, and the hypothesis being that somehow parasite infections restore the mucus barrier. No one was talking about this before he did this case study, right? Mm. And now everyone is looking at mucus. Like, how important is it? And it turns out mucus selects for the right microbes. You secrete things in your mucus that only certain microbes can degrade. So it's like you're feeding the right ones.
Right.
So what happens when you stop producing mucus for whatever reason? And then, first of all, the microbes come up right against you. So you get inflamed. Inflammation mm-hmm. itself selects for nasty bugs, possibly. So you end up in this feedback cycle where everything's going wrong. And then meanwhile, it's literally killing you, possibly. So anyways, I am not averse to, I think that scientists take more advantage of this underground movement. On the other hand, don't believe everything you hear out there, because there are a lot of vested interests in this working in the underground, because basically the people who are telling the stories are A, people who are selling the parasites, or B, mm-hmm. people who've paid thousands of dollars for the parasites, which I'm sorry to say skews your assessment of the results.
Sure. You want it to work when you spend that kind of money.
You're darn right.
Yeah. I'm personally fascinated by these therapies, and I actually, my story is that I went traveling in my 20s, spent a lot of time in places like Indonesia, and acquired a kind of something that I later found out was multiple parasitic infections. At the time, I didn't know. And while I was trying to figure out what was going on, one of the diagnoses I received, because I had a colonoscopy, the terminal ileum, my small intestine, was inflamed. And the guy who scoped me said, well, your intestine's inflamed. It looks kind of like Crohn's disease, but it might not be. And at that time, I was still kind of trying to determine, you know, what was happening. And so I pursued the autoimmune hypothesis, and was somewhat averse to the medication that was available, and so did some research and ended up trying the whipworm therapy. And I did a full course, maybe even a little longer than a full course, and it didn't work for me. And none of the sort of autoimmune stuff did. And I actually later found out that I had Entamoeba histolytica and some other not so nice parasites. And as soon as I got rid of those, I got better. But I've always been personally interested in these things and even willing to experiment on myself with them. But I think it seems pretty clear that the most effective way of putting this stuff into practice may not be for ourselves at this, you know, as adults, but for our children creating changes in the environment that might keep them from ever getting these conditions in the first place. So let's talk a little bit about what those changes might be and you know, maybe anything you're personally thinking of as a father now.
Right. You know, this is if you actually spent the time to read the whole book, which
I did.
It kind was of a long work.
One of the best science books I've ever written, Moises. I was incredible, and I highly recommend that everyone who's listening to this read it. It read like a cross between a detective novel and a really fascinating scientific study.
Well, thanks for the kudos. I mean, what I was going to say is that I make the reader wade through all the science, and in the end, there's not really much to say, right?
Oh, I don't know. I think there is. I mean, just even something as simple as the mother during pregnancy spending, you know, more if they have access to a farm or have a, you know, getting a pet if they don't already have a pet. I mean, a lot of this stuff is not proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, but I think some of the things you mentioned are worth at least talking about a little bit.
So the farm thing, what I usually do is I tell people what I would like to say and then what I can say. So what I would like to say is exactly that. I would like to say go to a farm as quick as possible while you're pregnant and take this antibiotic and possibly take this multicellular probiotic, aka a worm. The reality is that there are some studies actually, which I've come across since writing the book, that show that pregnant mothers who spend time around animals actually give birth to kids who have worse allergies.
Interesting.
These are not the same. Yeah. So these are not the same studies that are done in Central Europe. They're done in other countries. So it's hard to know what's happening. What seems to be true is that the environment that characterizes a barn in Germany or Bavaria, Bavaria is clearly in Germany, but in that sort of temperate zone where things are moldy and cool and moist, that environment protects.
Uh-huh.
Other environments maybe do not. And one of the possibilities is that you're actually getting zoonotic helminth infections. If you spend a lot of time around animals, you know, when you're pregnant in Africa, say, actually these weren't Africa, but in other parts. I guess the point is these are important switches in the body. And since we don't entirely understand how they work, it's entirely possible that we end up switching them the wrong way. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That said, the things that I think you can do for reals are like, don't worry about daycare. You know, daycare is pretty consistently protective for people with the right genotype, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this is gene environment interaction, but kids who go to daycare later on end up with fewer allergies pretty consistently. Even more easy and more important is just eat a good diet when you're pregnant. Don't eat a lot of junk food, which is pro-inflammatory. Eat more of a Mediterranean type diet or things that are full of sort of omega-3s and whole grains and fruits and vegetables if possible, right?
Mm-hmm.
Try to not develop inflammatory conditions like gestational diabetes, or try not to be overweight. I mean, that's actually probably asking a lot, since you may not be hearing this, you're already pregnant. But the point is to take care of yourself while this kid is forming inside you, you know, in its most plastic, vulnerable phases, really.
Mm-hmm.
And then early in life, don't be worried about other kids. Pets, yes, they seem to be pretty universally, especially around the pregnant mother.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is
breastfeeding,
yes, but again, there are nuances here. Like that celiac article, you know, overweight mothers, the colostrum, for example, has excess, according to one study anyways, excess pro-inflammatory factor. I mean, your whole immune system travels out in your breast milk. So however your immune system is working, it's going to come out in your breast milk and a signature of cytokines and antibodies and so on. So if you're overweight, it means probably that you're a little bit inflamed. You know, that's one of the, mm-hmm. the features of the metabolic syndrome. That's going to come out. And indeed, kids of mothers who are overweight are more likely to develop asthma, or one inflammatory disease, among other many other things, which are highly unpleasant. But what I would like to say at this point about breastfeeding is you, the mom, take some magical probiotic, eat a lot of prebiotics, eat a lot of omega-3s. All that stuff is going to come out of your breast milk. Mm-hmm. And breastfeed at the same time as you introduce the kid to foods, because then they're getting this hopefully cooling and peace-inducing effect through your breast milk while they're encountering food mm-hmm. proteins for the first time.
Mm-hmm. So what about this idea, and we actually didn't cover this in terms of viruses, but there, you mentioned in the book, there's some evidence that supports the idea that early exposure to H. pylori is protective. There's also some evidence that early exposure to viruses may be effective. And the way that might have happened, you know, in traditional societies is mothers chewing food. Mothers who had, you know, large percentage of people, for example, have, you know, antibodies to Epstein-Barr, for example. So What about that idea? Are you going to be chewing any food for your daughter?
Yeah.
Or your son, daughter?
Well, it's more like I end up eating her chewing food on the floor. But, you know, that is an interesting idea, and I wish it were investigated more, because it's not only when you chew food, not only do you pass on these potential, you know, amphibionts, which could be either good or bad. Mm-hmm. You also, in your saliva, there's all these antibodies, and there are good antibodies and bad antibodies. And if you have IgA, that's like a peaceful antibody. It's basically signaling, don't worry about whatever this is.
Yeah.
And there's tons of that in your saliva. So by chewing food, you possibly train the immune system to not respond to the food antigens or whatever else, right? I haven't put that into practice, honestly. I think it speaks to a much larger issue, though, of the timing, again, of when you get these viral infections or when you get a lot of these infections.
Right.
And sort of the one of the most interesting historical examples of that were the polio epidemics that emerged in the late 19th century in Northern Europe and then sort of spread. The polio virus has been around with us forever. Why did it start causing disease? It's because it was apparently getting introduced later and later as the cities cleaned up and as sewage mm-hmm. control went into effect.
Mm-hmm.
Early infection, babies don't have a problem because they're still being breastfed. They're still protected with those antibodies. Late infection, you become paralyzed, possibly die. But there's no new bug. There's just a change in the timing of its arrival. And that is so unexplored in terms of all of these. Again, you know, in terms of generally the thinking of the microbiota, people don't use timing. Timing is going to be very important. Like, you know, when the microbiota that you get in the first 2 years of age is going to be much more important than any probiotics you can take
later. As an adult. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's just not going to be the same. And so, you know, that speaks to another issue, which is early life antibiotic usage, which over and over keeps showing up as a predictor of asthma and inflammatory bowel disease now.
Mm-hmm.
So you think that maybe people who are sickly are more likely to take antibiotics. The problem is, in animal studies, they can basically knock out the anti-inflammatory bacteria with broad spectrum antibiotics, and then the mice become more prone to these diseases.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, obviously, life-threatening infections, you got to chew with antibiotics for your kid. But for myself, you know, listen to what your doctor says, number one, but ask your doctor, do we have to use antibiotics? Can we mm-hmm. is this maybe an infection? Is it not going to do anything? Otitis media, which they used to throw antibiotics at left and right without thinking, it turns out to be viral, and it clears up most of the time by itself.
Yeah.
So do we really need antibiotics for it?
Yeah, I think there's a lot more awareness about that, but I think we also have a ways to go. It seems to me they're still overprescribed, especially in young kids. So I'm in agreement with you on that. If, you know, there's certainly a time and a place for them, and they can save lives. But for me personally, I would definitely consider them as something I would try only when there aren't other viable options. So, Moises, I want to thank you for coming on the show again. It's one of the best books I've ever read, and I've read a lot of science books because I'm a science geek. So I really enjoyed it. Fascinating topic, and I highly recommend checking it out if you haven't. I know I've mentioned it on the show a few times. It's called The Epidemic of Absence. And yeah, thanks again, Moises, and hopefully we can meet up now that we're neighbors.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks again, terrific. And look forward to meeting you in person.
Likewise.